Welcome back to the CMDA Matters podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Mike Chupp, and this week we have an accomplished physician who turned author and speaker after several years of private practice. Dr. Leonard Sachs is our guest this week, and he's also going to be our guest next week as a part two for this podcast because we found him to be an incredible resource on the troubling topic of transgenderism in kids. I say we because Dr. Jeff Barrows, our CMDA Vice President for Bioethics and Public Policy, joined me in this timely discussion with Dr. Sachs, who's a board-certified family physician. And our discussion is about why gender is not as malleable as our culture may think. Dr. Sachs graduated Phi Beta Kappa from MIT in Cambridge, Massachusetts, believe it or not, at the age of 19. He then went on to the University of Pennsylvania, where he earned both a PhD in psychology combined with his MD degree. He did a three-year residency in family medicine in Lancaster, Pennsylvania, and has been continuously certified by the American Board of Family Medicine since 1989. Since 2001, he has visited and worked with more than 400 schools, as well as universities, corporations, community groups, and parent groups. In 2005, publisher Doubleday put out his first book, Why Gender Matters, and then updated a new edition in 2017. He has since written three other books, including Boys Adrift, Girls on the Edge, and New York Times bestseller, The Collapse of Parenting. Dr. Sachs lives with his wife and daughter in Chester County, Pennsylvania, where he also continues to see patients on a regular basis in his practice. Well, in our conversation today, we refer to Dr. Sachs's essay in the Witherspoon Institute's blog called Public Discourse. And I find this an excellent public policy weekly newsletter. I try to read it every weekend. Dr. Sachs's essay was entitled Politicizing Pediatrics, How the American Academy of Pediatrics Transgender Guidelines Undermine Trust in Medical Authority. I welcome you to listen in to part one of Dr. Sachs on sex and why gender matters in healthcare more than ever before. Well, thank you for joining us today, and I really appreciate you being willing to talk about the really hot topic, politicizing pediatrics, how the American Academy of Pediatrics transgender guidelines undermine trust in medical authority. I'm joined here in the studio with me is Dr. Jeff Barrows. Both Jeff and I were introduced to you basically earlier this year through a public discourse article that you wrote.
Yes, I wrote that last year. My late mom was a pediatrician and professor of pediatrics at Case Western. And I was raised to revere the American Academy of Pediatrics and to regard their guidelines as gospel. And for my first 30 years as a doctor, that's exactly how I regarded them. It was such a shock because prior to that, those transgender guidelines, really, the American Academy guidelines were typically based in evidence and useful and reliable. And this was such an extraordinary departure from the history and tradition of the American Academy of Pediatrics. I wrote a letter to the editor, which was vetted and published on the American Academy website alongside the guidelines, and it's still there. And there's been only two letters published, mine and a pediatrician from Baltimore who agrees with me. You know, I've been reading the guidelines in the comments for 30-some years. Normally, when a doctor writes a very negative comment saying these guidelines are totally ridiculous, the authors will then weigh in and say, well, Dr. So-and-so doesn't understand, and here's the citations that he has misunderstood, and here is how he has misunderstood them. No response was ever posted. I waited 6 months. They never posted a response, and that is what prompted me to write the longer article for public discourse, because I was just so astonished that the American Academy of Pediatrics would go off the deep end in this way.
Well, let's back up a little bit, Dr. Sachs, and just a little bit about your story. After practicing for 18 years, you decided to take a five-year sabbatical between 2008 and 2013, and you devoted yourself to full-time visiting schools and communities and to writing. You've published a number of books, one that both Dr. Barrows and I have just read of yours, which was redone in 2017, entitled Why Gender Matters, another book, Boys Adrift, another one, Girls on the Edge, another, The Collapse of Parenting. Just tell us about what led to you taking that five-year sabbatical.
Well, as I mentioned, I'm a family doctor. My wife and I started a practice in Montgomery County, Maryland, back in 1990, just outside Washington, D.C. And over those years as a family doctor, I saw so many families where the daughter was doing well and working hard, and the son was a goofball who was more interested in playing video games. Same parents, same resources, but very different outcomes, depending whether the kid happened to be male or female. And that led me to write my first book, Why Gender Matters, and then my second book, Boys Adrift. And both books were unexpectedly popular and led to a great many invitations to visit schools and speak to parents and speak to teachers. And I've now visited over 460 schools over the last 19 years.
Wow, that's impressive.
And I found that I really enjoyed visiting schools and listening to teachers and parents and sharing what I was learning about how you get boys excited about Emily Dickinson, how you get girls excited about computer coding. My wife and I agreed that we would sell the practice to the physician that I had hired, and he's still there, and devote myself full time, at least for a couple years, to visiting schools and speaking. The other twist in the story is that we thought we were infertile, and then we discovered we were not. We got our one and only daughter, and so that meant we had to find a good school. And we were not satisfied with the schools available, public or private. So we moved to Chester County, Pennsylvania, in large part to find a school that we thought would be a better fit for our one and only child.
Well, Dr. Sachs, I did enjoy reading Why Gender Matters, and I got the sense, I want our listeners to understand that you, in addition to having an MD, have a PhD in psychology, and I got a sense from reading the book that you probably did a fair amount of counseling in your practice as well. Am I right in that?
Yes, absolutely. Again, I think any good family doctor needs to do counseling, and it helps to have a PhD in psychology.
I'd say, yes.
Yeah, a big chunk of primary care is teaching and counseling.
Well, CMDA, we're very interested and got engaged in a federal lawsuit, Dr. Sachs, back in 2016. And this will help you, as well as some of our listeners who are not aware, that in 2016, HHS put out a rule as part of Section 1557 of the Affordable Care Act that really mandated various specialists taking care of children and adults, that if me as a general surgeon, pediatrician, plastic surgery, that whatever procedures we offer to any of our patients, we had to offer those procedures to patients who were coming out as transgender and wanted procedures to transition. And that was a mandate, or else risk our members, others losing their ability to be reimbursed by Medicare. And that lawsuit has gone in a good direction. That rule has been axed. But it certainly put our members, listeners, those who side with us on this perspective that transgenderism and transitioning procedures have not really been shown to be better than watchful waiting. And so how transgenderism is harming our youth, I think we'd like to hear from you. What do you see are the things that are happening because of a lack of evidence-based medicine and a gold standard that was shared on this program many months ago by one of our members, Dr. Andre Valmal, that the gold standard, according to him, still in the literature is watchful waiting?
Well, again, I think that any guidance needs to be based in evidence. So let's imagine a seven-year-old boy who comes to you and says that he is a girl. What is best practice? Well, we have a lot of research on this. Again, we don't have to guess. We have scholars who have studied this issue, who have followed individuals for 20 years or more. So, for example, we have many longitudinal cohort studies, meaning studies in which researchers find children like this and then follow them for 15, 20 years. So we have a pretty good notion of what is likely to happen with this boy. We have, as I said, many studies in which they follow boys from early ages through adolescence and into adulthood. And what we can say based on this research is that when you follow this boy, where is he likely to be 15 years down the road? It is very unlikely that this young man at 22 or 25 years of age will say that he is female. He may say that he is a gay man. He may be a straight man. So in view of that research, it is best practice to, as you said, watchful waiting. Now, what does that mean? It doesn't mean that you ignore this kid. Mm-hmm. It doesn't mean that you ignore what he's saying. On the contrary, you want to understand where this is coming from. And you really, if you're the clinician, you really need to get to know this kid. So when researchers look at this particular situation, this seven-year-old boy who says he's a girl, in some cases you find out that he's being bullied by his older brother, who doesn't bully the younger sister. And the boy believes, well, if I was just a girl, I wouldn't be bullied. That was one case report. Another case report is a boy who loves ballet and wants to do ballet, but all the boys he knows want to play football and whack each other with lightsabers, which he has no interest in doing, and the only kids he sees his age doing ballet are girls. So he thinks, well, I must be a girl. And what you say to that boy is, hey, you want to study ballet? That's wonderful. We are going to support you in that, but you are going to study ballet as a boy, not as a girl. And there are many great dancers, Baryshnikov and so forth, who are men. And you can absolutely study ballet. You need to broaden kids' understanding of the variety of human experience. Mm-hmm. There's more than one way to be a boy. There is more than one way to be a girl. And one of the points I make in my book, Why Gender Matters, is that an ironic consequence of this transgender activism has been a hardening of gender stereotypes. So, for example, my daughter, her dream is to be a pilot for the United States Air Force. She very much hopes to attend the United States Air Force Academy, where her cousin, Aiden, attends. She wants to be a pilot for the United States Air Force. And yet, when you find a teenage girl, when people encounter a teenage girl whose dream is to be a combat pilot, you will now have people saying, oh, what are your preferred pronouns? Are you transitioning to the male role? No, there's more than one way to be a girl. Not all girls have to like Barbie. No, just because a girl wants to fly for the United States Air Force doesn't mean that she's transgender. That's what's really weird about this transgender activism, is that if you're a girl and you don't like Barbies, are you a boy? If you're a boy and you want to do ballet, have you considered transitioning to the female role? So best practice, supported by many studies following kids over many years, indicates supportive, watchful waiting, because the odds are on the order of 10 to 1 that down the road, this boy isn't going to want to be a female, in which case putting him an address and changing his name to Emily is not helping this boy. And yet, that's exactly what the American Academy of Pediatrics now recommends. What really troubles me about this whole transgender movement is not only that the gender dysphoric kid is being harmed, but the way it is having a harmful effect on other kids, on many other kids. So let's say you've got a 10-year-old kid attending a school where the principal announces, hey, remember Jason? Well, Jason is now Emily, and you are all to address this individual as Emily. And Emily's a girl. If you ever address him as Jason, that's going to be subject to discipline, because that's dead naming, and That is just as bad as calling a black person the N-word. You must never do that. This individual's Emily will be using the girls' bathroom, and that's the law. And this is happening at thousands of schools across the United States right now. What message is that giving a 10-year-old boy, a 10-year-old girl, about gender? As many have observed, schools that used to have bake sales now have Transgender Day, where they celebrate these kids and hold up this 10-year-old individual as being courageous and wonderful. And kids are looking at this, and it is confusing. Because if there's one thing that should be foundational about a child's identity, it's whether you're a boy or a girl. Mm-hmm. But what this is teaching this 10-year-old kid is that that's not foundational. That can change. And it can change overnight, just depending on whether you want it to change. You're introducing confusion where there should not be confusion. And one of the points I make in the closing chapters of my book, Why Gender Matters, is that when kids are confused about their gender, bad outcomes become much more likely. And so best practice based on the research, you shouldn't confuse kids about their gender. And yet that's exactly what our culture is doing now. In California, as a matter of public law, they're required to begin this sex education in the elementary school, telling kids that, hey, you want to change to the opposite sex? That's great. And we will support you. That's wonderful. Anybody can do it. And it's up to you, the child. That's really harmful, immensely harmful. And we know it is. We don't have to guess. We have studies showing this, which I cite in my book. And it is troubling that state authorities are putting in place policies which we know will be harmful for kids. And they're putting this in place because of a political agenda. That's really upsetting. Mm-hmm. Adolescents have always struggled with the question of who am I and who do I want to become? And struggling with that question is part of the work of adolescence, and that's okay. But instead of making that work easier, our state authorities and our medical leadership are deliberately making it harder, and that's troubling.
Yeah, and that really brings up a question I wanted to ask you, Dr. Sachs. So let's just take this same 7-year-old boy, and you're a family physician in practice, and you tell that basically what you've just said to the parents, and they bring that child back 2 years later who is still saying that he feels that he is a girl, and this time they're getting more pressure from the school, from teachers, the school administrator, that they need to begin thinking about starting that child on puberty blockers and maybe even down the road cross-sex hormones. What advice would you give to that family physician that's in that pressure?
Well, you mentioned earlier some federal guidelines. I am talking to people, especially I hear stories from California. In California, if you take your child to a counselor or psychologist for evaluation in this setting, and the psychologist recommends watchful waiting, that psychologist could lose their license to practice, because California now has in place a state law that says that such a recommendation constitutes conversion therapy. And conversion therapy is unlawful under California law. So I'm hearing stories about counselors in California who will write one thing on the chart and then whisper something else to the parents, because if they put down in writing that they suggested watchful waiting, they are putting their license at risk. And California is not the only such state. New Jersey, Massachusetts also have similar laws in place. So it's very difficult for parents, because you have to find a good counselor. And I get emails very often, including several just this week, just in the past 7 days, from parents who have asked me, who can I find? Who can I talk to in my area? Because all the counselors I'm talking to are saying, yes, I have to immediately transition my child to the opposite sex. And if I don't, I am liable to lose my child, Child Protective Services will intervene. So this is a very scary time for parents. And parents need to do what is best for their child, which is now getting more difficult. And in some locations, in some states, it is perilous. So I advise those parents, you need to listen to your heart. Do what is right for your child. Find good professional help. And that may mean traveling. It may mean moving. And I'm not asking those parents to do anything I did not do. My wife and I moved from Maryland to Pennsylvania to find a better school for our only child. Your child has to be your first priority. And if that means moving, then you have to move.
Well, we will continue that interview next week as part of our weekly podcast. The transgender controversy has certainly become a focal point of our national discussion, showcasing diametrically opposed worldviews in our society today. I wanted to suggest some excellent resources on this particular topic in addition to Dr. Sachs's book, Why Gender Matters. And that book's available on Amazon, including the audiobook version on Audible. Well, one of those resources is the book by Ryan Anderson, When Harry Became Sally. It provides a more accurate picture of what trans people actually experience. Ryan draws on best insights from biology, psychology, and philosophy. He's from the Heritage Foundation and offers a balanced approach to the policy issues, a nuanced vision of human embodiment, and a sober and honest survey of the human costs of getting human nature wrong. He reveals a grim contrast between the media's sunny depiction and the often sad realities of gender identity struggles. He introduces us as readers to people who tried to transition but found themselves actually no better off. Especially troubling is the suffering felt by adults who were encouraged to transition as children but later came to regret it. And there is a reason that many do regret it. As Anderson shows, the most helpful therapies focus not on achieving the impossible, changing bodies to conform to thoughts and feelings, but on helping people accept and even embrace the truth about their bodies and reality. This discussion, I think, will be of particular interest to parents that you heard Leonard referring to at the end, who are panicking and fear how an ideological school counselor might just try to steer their child in the wrong direction. The best evidence, as you heard from Dr. Sachs today, shows that the vast majority of children will desist from a gender-conflicted phase. But no one knows how new school policies might just affect children indoctrinated to believe that they really are trapped in the wrong body. Finally, the book God and the Transgender Debate by Southern Seminary professor Dr. Andrew Walker is a warm, faithful, and careful book that helps Christians understand what the Bible actually says about gender identity. Reverend Walker partnered with CMDA recently and gave an excellent two-hour webinar presentation entitled Healthcare Professionals, the Church, and the Transgender Movement. This webinar is actually still available for your viewing. Just go to cmda.org/transgender, where you will find the link to that powerful presentation, as well as many other articles and books that we think will be most valuable to you in caring for patients who are struggling with these gender issues in our culture right now. You can get a copy of these last two books at cmda.org/store, or over the phone, just call 888-230-2637.
This is Dr. Jeff Barrows bringing you our update regarding our public policy ministry in Washington, D.C. Whatever administration is in power, we speak out to support good policies and also to oppose bad policies. But we were recently pleased to support a multilateral international agreement that sends a clear message to the United Nations and the World Health Organization. That message is stop pressuring countries to submit to a radical abortion agenda and focus instead on consensus global health issues. Led by the United States and now joined by 31 other countries, the Geneva Consensus Declaration lays down four pillars of priorities for international healthcare programs. In our news release about this declaration, as an OBGYN, I acknowledged that the four pillars of the Geneva Consensus Declaration, improving women's health, preserving human life, strengthening the family, and protecting national sovereignty, provide a noble framework for consensus global engagement on women's health issues. CMA Director of Federal Government Relations, Jonathan Imbody, also pointed out in that same news release that when surveyed on women's global health, our members serving in medical missions around the world have overwhelmingly agreed that rather than advocating for abortion rights, the international health community, governments, and international bodies should instead focus their energy, time, and resources on meeting women's health needs, since there is widespread agreement on strategies to accomplish those goals. Rest assured that during this coming administration, we will continue to serve as your voice in Washington, D.C., speaking truth to power, supporting what we understand from the scriptures to be right, and opposing what is wrong.
Well, this is my first opportunity to announce some exciting news. Registration for our Remedy 2021 Virtual Healing for a World in Crisis conference event is now open. For the first time ever, the Remedy conference will be webcast live across the nation on January 9th and 10th. That'll be a Saturday and a Sunday, and we want you to have a front row seat for this extraordinary experience. Remedy 2021 will be live simulcast from three different sites across the nation, involve plenary speakers involved in missions both overseas and domestically. You won't want to miss it. Many breakout speakers as well. Please just go to remedy.cmda.org to find out more information and to register today for that event. I'd also like to invite you to join us for the annual VIE poster session at the CMDA National Convention in Ridgecrest, North Carolina. Dates are April 29th through May 2nd, 2021. Any pre-healthcare student, medical student, resident, fellow, or faculty member in the healthcare field is eligible to participate. The list of possible presentation topics is actually quite long, and it's free to submit your project proposal, but you've got to do it by November 30th. You can find out more information about the VIE poster session that we have each year at cmda.org/VIE. Well, in closing, our Board of Trustees has been working very hard with our Ethics Committee at CMDA on an update to our position statement on transgenderism. There was already one that was has been approved and online, dating back, I believe, to 2014. But with all of the changes and all the focus on this topic as we've been discussing today, our board felt that it was time for an update. We trust that by the annual House of Representatives meeting in late April 2021, we will be able to officially release this extremely well-thought-out statement to our members and other constituents. One of our board members, who has an extensive background in bioethics, sent me an email this week after some deep meditation about this troubling challenge in our culture today. I found his thoughts so insightful. He wrote to me, "Mike, the idea of separating gender from sex is an example of a universal human aspiration to be transformed to a better state. But in the case of transgenderism, this aspiration is misplaced. The transgender pundits are persuading people, by suggestion or example, to transform their bodies in response to a transformation of the mind that rejects inherited biology. In other words, rejects the created order for our bodies and aspires to replace it with something different and of our own making. This theme is similar in some respects but quite different in content, to the Christian call to be transformed, as Paul expressed, by the renewing of our minds, putting off the old self, that biological self that inherits original sin, and becoming new, mentally and spiritually, through Christ. The transgender phenomenon is no less than a spiritual movement, and its message, its hope, its gospel, and its means to break free from discomfort are very different from, and I would say, incompatible with the transformation that Christians seek, and the hope to which Christ invites everyone. Salvation in Christ transcends sex and gender, and is a true hope in which sin and evil will finally be overcome. And he concludes with this: there is a common ground here. We all realize that humanity is in need of transformation. The question is how, and by whom, and by what means. People with gender dysphoria get that, but they are being directed wrongly and to a false salvation. Doctors should not be co-opted to clear the road for this ultimately futile spiritual project. A far better hope is to be found in Christ. I really appreciated that insightful email from our board member. You know, we are fearfully and wonderfully made in the image of God, as either male or female, the way God created us to be. It is futile to try and separate our gender from our biological sexual identity. No matter what a leading secular professional organization for children like the AAP declares with their scant evidence. We agree with Dr. Sachs at CMDA that gender based upon reality and biology, it matters. I believe it also matters to you, and so it matters to CMDA. And CMDA Matters. Thanks for listening today. Be sure to join us next week for part two of our discussion with Dr. Leonard Sachs on why gender matters more than ever for healthcare professionals who follow Christ. We'll see you next week, God willing.
This podcast has been a production of the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. The opinions expressed by guests on this podcast are not necessarily endorsed by the Christian Medical and Dental Associations. CMDA is a nonpartisan organization that does not endorse political parties or candidates for public office. The views expressed on this podcast reflect judgments regarding principles and values held by CMDA and its members, and are not intended to imply endorsement of any political party or candidate.